Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's
world service.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
You can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist. But having said that, I want to be like me.
I'd say it to you, face, and I'll see them. What you doing down here, you shawnee man?
Trent Alexander-Arnold was briefly knocked out of his stride yesterday in his post-match interview with Jeff Shreves when it was put to him that one of the Arsenal goals came down his side before he went on to have a big hand in Liverpool's equaliser. Now, Alexander-Arnold, he struggled to respond for a few moments before pointing out politely that the goals have to come from one of the sides or down the middle. That's the way football works, Jeff. It was a type of response that made me think maybe Trent is aware of the constant analysis of his defensive failings and doesn't really enjoy having every single goal Liverpool concede pinned on his shoulders. But there is a solution to all this, which I'm prepared to proffer on today's Second Captain's Football Podcast. Hi, Ken.
Owen, how are you?
It's actually Daniel Harris's solution in The Guardian. He writes, just as we saw his fallibility against Arsenal, we also saw his brilliance stepping into midfield, dictating attacks and creating his team's equaliser. Wait for it, Ken. It may be time he moved into the centre permanently. Partly because Liverpool have a vacancy there, but mainly because the position is ideal for hiding his weaknesses, a lack of nous, recovery pace and one-on-one ability, and accentuating the passing, vision and crossing that are his strengths. It's a brilliant idea, Ken. I mean, why hasn't somebody else thought of this? That's what I say.
Yeah, people sometimes come to similar conclusions from different paths. You know, there's more than one way, one road to Rome, you know. In fact, all the roads apparently lead there. So it is possible, I suppose, to reach the conclusion that Trent Alexander-Arnold should play central midfield because you think he's such a bad player that he can't play right back. The position is ideal for hiding his weaknesses. A lack of nous. Nous is one of those words we use in football, which means players who are near a goal that gets let in don't have any. Recovery pace, apparently he's slow. And one-on-one ability, whatever that means. I mean, I suppose he nutmegged Zinchenko yesterday, but I suppose he has occasionally been dribbled past as well by players. So, I mean, the idea, when you're a player with so many weaknesses, I mean, where better to play than the center of the match? I mean, this logic might make...
It doesn't matter how people get to this.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter how people get to this conclusion. You're leading a movement here, Ken. If you're having followers, if you're having disciples,
no,
come
I'm,
on board
I'm a purist.
With you. You need to accept.
I'm an ideological purist. I don't accept people who are here for the wrong reasons. I think Daniel Harris is here for the wrong reasons. I think his argument makes sense if you don't think about it at all. You know, it might make sense if you just completely turned your brain in a different direction. But I just don't see the logic of the argument that this guy is so bad he has to be moved into central midfield to disguise all of
his
shortcomings.
Well, no, he's so bad at right back he has to be. Well, that's partly your rationale as well.
No, my rationale is actually more positive, which is that he is too good to play right back. And I think that a lot of the problems that he has have to do with the... I mean, he's not necessarily too good to play right back. It depends on the team. But I think particularly when you look at the Liverpool team at the moment, it's clear that they, you know, really miss central midfielders. And again, I am sorry for... It sounds like I've started this Bank Holiday podcast just by mounting my hobby horse and parading around again, as usual.
No, I have mounted you on your hobby horse, exactly. Ken. It was intended to be a brief visit upon your hobby horse, but I intended to move on. But now I'm quite taken by the fact that you're so particular about the rationale that different people have for agreeing with your basic position, which is that he has deficiencies defensively at right back. And
I think the problem that he has is related to the fact that that what they're asking him to do in the team is actually too much. You know, the problem is, like, say, for instance, yesterday he was playing, Liverpool seemed to be doing some kind of cargo cult version of what Man City have been doing recently with the three, the kind of so-called rest defense, you know, the three across the back and then two in front. And so City have been using John Stones as a midfielder effectively in this sense, although he's a defender when they're defending. And Alexander-Arnold, I guess, was being asked to do this. So you might look at that and say, well, look, he's playing in midfield already. Like, well, you know, what are you talking about? He already gets to play in midfield. But the problem with that is he's still supposed to be the right back. And so still he's supposed to defend everything that comes down one of the sides, as Jeff Shreves would point out. And I think that's a lot. Like, you're not asking, you know, Kevin De Bruyne, who plays as a, you know, he's a creative playmaker, to also, oh, by the way,
you do ask Man City's fullbacks to step into midfield actually quite a lot and then ask them to step back. Although not Kyle Walker, who Pep said this weekend is incapable of doing that.
I mean, that was amazing from Pep, wasn't it? He just can't do it. Kyle Walker,
how would I ask? I mean, he's fast, sure. He'll be fast when he's 60. He'll be the fastest person in the room when he's 60.
I thought that made it worse, actually, you know? When he was like praising, oh, his Walker's so physical, he's so strong, he's so fast, but no, he's just, despite all that, he's still not good enough. He's such a he's so feeble on the ball that I can't possibly risk him. Even though at 60 years old, he'd be faster than everybody here, and I don't just mean actually everybody here. Well, maybe Pep just did mean, looking down at you, the media. I'm pretty sure the 60-year-old Kyle Walker will still be faster than any of you guys. Actually, that's probably true. I wondered if he meant, you know, at 60 he'll still be, you know, the top three fastest players in my squad. Anyway, I think it's asking too much. If you have a player who's a creative midfielder, you don't also ask him to be a defender and have to stand there explaining to Jeff Shreves that goals have to come down one side. I mean, Trent Alexander-Arnold could have explained, yeah, there was actually a goal down each side in the game. If you look at it, there was one down my side, one down Robertson's side, one down Ben White's side, and one down Zinchenko's side. You might remember that one because I was involved in that. Like Ben White, for example, didn't set up a goal, was beaten in the air by Firmino to the equaliser, and the first goal came down his side. Now, why isn't he hauled out and sort of made to answer for this? You know, do you realise, Ben?
Because it hasn't happened. It hasn't happened repeatedly to Ben White in the way it has happened.
Well, maybe Ben White's been clever here by not getting involved in, you know, by not sort of setting up 18 goals in a Premier League season or whatever Alexander-Arnold's number was. You know, maybe he's done well to sort of fly beneath the radar in that sense. You know, but the point is about the I think there's a kind of an obsession with criticizing Trent Alexander-Arnold particularly, which isn't really justified by, you know, how bad he is. Having said that, you know, I do basically agree with what Daniel Harris is saying, but obviously he's saying this for all the wrong reasons.
Almost 8 minutes on Trent. That was not my intention, but listen, it's a bank holiday. Well, it is in Ireland anyway, so we're on the internet. We can do what we want. Richard Jolly and Irish Blog's Andrew Mangan on the pod today to talk about an extraordinary game of football at Anfield yesterday. The US Masters will be covered on the World Service tomorrow, when Murph will also be back to talk about a crazy opening weekend in the Connacht Championship. We've got a chat lined up for Wednesday's show about the Republic of Ireland women's team, who play the second of their matches against the USA on Tuesday night / the early hours of Wednesday morning. It's Champions League quarterfinal week, featuring Man City versus Bayern and Real Madrid versus Frank Lampard's Chelsea, as we can now call them once again. So a hell of a week in the World Service. Have a think about becoming a member if you aren't one already. It's €5 a month plus VAT.
Yeah, I was watching the Ireland's USA game on Saturday evening, and the bad news out of that one was the American player who you might have seen getting injured, Miles Swanson. It was pretty bad injury. You could even tell that it was one of those, like, she had sort of fallen in such a way as you could see the knee, and the knee just didn't look like a knee normally looks. And it turns out that she has done her patellar tendon, which I guess, given that the World Cup is in July, means that she won't be playing in the World Cup. So that's a bad one for the Americans. From Ireland's point of view, what the thing that struck me was how uniform the style is now across men's and women's national teams. I was looking at it, particularly in the first half, when Ireland were more in the game, I think, thinking, this is exactly the same formation as we played against France. This is it. Like, I recognized the five defenders and then the little narrow pentagon in the middle. We're doing exactly the same thing. And actually, I thought, the score obviously was 2-0, but I thought they played very well. I mean, you know, in the sense that this is...
Oh, it was working in the first half. There was a goal disallowed. There was a couple of goal-mouth scrambles. Thought it was a fairly even game in the first half. It was quite encouraging.
Yeah, you know, the goal was disallowed. It was a pretty marginal offside. I mean, it was kind of... I'm not even sure if the offside player necessarily touched the ball. Maybe there was a tiny header on it. And, okay, it was offside. But, you know, you could see how Ireland can stay competitive in games against... I mean, the American national team, although, you know, they seem to think that their team at the moment isn't quite as good as it was, say, when they won the World Cup last time. You know, they're obviously one of the top teams in the world. And to stay competitive in the game for that long, I thought was impressive. You know, I mean, because I kind of get the impression with Ireland, you know, people don't think they can get out of the group. And if they can play like that
against... No, it's a really hard group that we've... Yeah,
but if you can play like that against a team like the United States, then, you know, it's possible. I mean, you can. It definitely. I mean, it wasn't the kind of. I mean, there's another game to come on Tuesday. We'll see how that one goes. But it's not. It's not the case of, oh, this is a heavy defeat. Oh wow, we're miles off that level. It was, this game was close enough that a couple of details, you know, going differently. I mean, obviously the kind of closing stages of the game, there was a lot more pressure from the Americans, but overall I thought it was pretty strong.
Yeah, we have brought in quite a few new players since qualifying as well. This is always the delicate balancing act. What is a player going to add to the squad, and is it going to disrupt what's already there?
Hey, we all want Ireland to succeed, right, Owen?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And maybe we have a better chance of that with Sinead Farrelly in there, who made her debut at the weekend and was absolutely raved about by Vera Powell afterwards, who Vera Powell feels that Farrelly's presence in the team allowed us to essentially change our entire tactical approach, which is a pretty pretty significant impact. So we'll talk about all that on the show on Wednesday. I've got an email in here, Ken, from Philip Green. Thought it was strange all week how much more focus and attention was being paid specifically to Arsenal going to Anfield. John Tolu wrote a great piece about how the atmosphere could engulf some players. Arteta was speaking about that weird "you'll never walk alone" speaker stunt that he tried during All or Nothing. There was talk of an Arsenal Anfield hoodoo. Even saw Arsenal fans on my timeline calling this Arsenal's biggest game in a decade. It felt a little overblown. The team in first place going to play the team in eighth. Has nobody watched Liverpool play recently? The first half an hour looked like proving me right. Arsenal bullied and toyed with Liverpool and hadn't gotten out of third gear to be leading 2-0. The game was on a plate for Arsenal, the young vibrant team putting yesterday's men to the sword. But then something weird happened. Arsenal willed the Anfield hoodoo into existence by getting involved in a couple of instances of needless messing. They gave Liverpool and the crowd a spark that seemed missing up until that point. It reminded me a bit of Arteta's clash with Klopp a few years ago, when a placid 0-0 was turned into a 4-0 hammering after Arteta handed the crowd a match to light the spark. Arsenal started treating Liverpool yesterday more and more like the side they've been for the last 5 years, and in turn, Liverpool started to act like it. With Ramsdale's brilliant performance and the missed penalty, Arsenal might be able to push the idea they dug in for a hard-fought point, but the reality is they spent the week leading into the game telling themselves a ghost story and ended up getting spooked by it. Anyway, just a thought. Go easy, Phil.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of that. I really do. You know, it's funny how these things happen, and I think it's a good point to mention the previous one. I remember the Arteta and Klopp fight on the sideline. That would, that again was one of those kind of, this game hasn't really taken off. And then before you know it, it was 4-0. As the crowd really got into it. I think that's kind of a bit of a problem for Liverpool, to be honest, that it seems to take something extraneous to, you know, be the little piece of grit in the oyster that like gets them going, because you really have to find a way to do that themselves, you know, without being disrespected in some way. Like, yeah. it's nonsense. But it's sort of interesting just in terms of how football really is, like how it just tiny little things that happen set in train a kind of a process that develops momentum and turns into an avalanche. This is the thing that Klopp has been trying to talk about for the last few weeks, you know, that, and he's never sounded less convincing or convinced, I think, than in the last few weeks, which there's been terrible results from this team. And even this is like, you know, they haven't won in four matches. Was it five matches? Four. They haven't won in four, and it's two draws. That, you know, they dropped 10 points in the last four Premier League matches. So it's been a really awful run in four. I mean, consider how different their situation would be if they'd got it together for these matches in the way they managed to do for, you know, an hour or 45 minutes against Arsenal. But he, you know, when he's talking about why the team is playing badly, he always ends up talking about you have to win a challenge. You know, it's like Keane says the same stuff. You know what I mean? This is something they basically agree on. That, like, winning a challenge, like kicking a ball out for a throw that looked like it was going to turn into a chance for the other team, can change the course of a match. You know, this is actually what it is. It's like, you do that and then you suddenly feel, what was the phrase Klopp used? You don't worry about confidence. You never think about confidence when you have it. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just, I have it and now... let's go. It's only when you don't have it that you're like, oh, how can I get confidence? And this is literally it. So Xhaka did, I mean, obviously Xhaka didn't intend to do this, but obviously what he did actually did have a big impact. I mean, I saw Ian Wright last night sort of trying to defend him. And I don't think he should be like hung out, oh, how could you do this? It was stupid. You know, Xhaka has played a brilliant season. His best for Arsenal, probably. He showed that definitely his best for Arsenal. I mean, last season was also pretty good. He showed, I mean, I remember when he was coming off that time and the whole Emirates was booing him and he was throwing his shirt down and that, you assume, okay, well, he's gone. That's it for him. He's actually showed that he's a really important player to the team, has turned all that around, which deserves a lot of respect. In this instant, he was at the center of the moment that seemed to turn the match around a little bit. Obviously, the narrative that followed helps.
I mean, we'll talk to Andrew Mangan about this.
I think it really did. I think Liverpool's attitude completely changed, which is a problem for Liverpool, really, because, you know, you can't be relying on, like, you know, people sort of disrespecting you to start playing well. But yeah, I did think in the game that I watched, though, and it felt like a big moment, even at the time.
Do you believe in coincidence, though, Ken? Do you believe that potentially Liverpool were going to wake up from this at some point, and Arsenal also were going to start feeling the heat at some point?
Why were they going to wake up at some point? I mean,
it came shortly after.
You know, they've been so bad. I mean, that's the point that Philip Green, King of the High Street, makes in his email. He says, have they not seen how they've been playing? They've been so terrible. I mean, they were so awful against Man City.
Not at home, though. Not at home.
Well, yeah,
this comes back to the Anfield thing.
It's true. I mean, they rattled
Real Madrid at home for a short period.
Yeah, I mean, they were pretty awful in that too. So, I mean, what I'm saying, they've just had lots of defeats. Obviously, really fragile confidence. They're 2-0 down against the league leading side. You don't. I wasn't expecting them to come back at that point, and then the game kind of changed. And I think that Arsenal's attitude fed into that in a number of ways. I thought they tried to slow the game down too much. I think that you can't afford to do that. I mean, it's one thing to do that. See, in the game, the pressure was on Arsenal, right? I mean, they were the ones with. I mean, I can remember slowing the game down, obviously working really well. In the famous Liverpool-Chelsea Gerrard game, you know, that was Chelsea's idea from the start, you know, Mourinho's idea, let's take ages for the goal kicks. I can remember Liverpool players losing their heads in the first few minutes of the game. Can you believe how long this guy is taking to take a goal kick? you know, grabbing the ball from Mourinho, who's trying to keep it off him on the side, you know, this kind of stuff, because they were the ones who were hurrying and needed a goal and who all the pressure was on, because Chelsea had kind of blown it at that stage. Arsenal were the ones who were under the pressure here. I just feel that, like, inviting an hour of saying, okay, it's 2-0, let's see if you can score two goals now, is too much when you're actually the team that's under pressure. Like, the fear that must have been building on Arsenal, which I think was evident in Arteta's substitutions as he took off Odegaard and put on Kivior, the extra defender, changed the shape of the team. It was kind of, he needed to be braver there. I think the pressure maybe caused him to go more negative. It wasn't Arteta's finest hour, I don't think, this Arsenal game. But we can talk about
it. It was interesting, because afterwards he was being asked about the resilience that Arsenal showed towards the end when they dug in for... it's a weird one, because I don't know if it was exactly the word that was used, but it was along those lines. And I don't know how resilient a team can be lauded as being when they've given away a two-goal lead in a game in which they were comfortable. But you get the point. That was the tone. It could have been worse. They could easily have lost that game.
Well, they should have lost. And you can only imagine the psychological damage and everything. Penalty. I mean, maybe try getting your next penalty on target.
The Ramsdale save as well. The Ramsdale save on Salah especially. That save would have been
a great save.
Pretty good save, even if there was no deflection. You know, it looked like it was quite well struck going towards the top corner. It required a good save. And the deflection just made it absolutely one of the best of the season. He also made the one afterwards.
The Kanate one was incredible. But the Kanate one is like, how did he manage to bundle the ball? Sort of the only place Ramsdale could get it. You know, it looks...
Yeah, he gave him a half a chance. But the point about the answer that Arteta gave was basically, I don't want to be... He wasn't really bigging up that element. He was like, I don't want to be relying on those sort of situations and having to show resilience. I want to rely on what we did in the first half and the way we played early on in the game. That's the way we're going to win the league, you know?
Yeah.
That he partly contributed to the situation that they found themselves in the second half.
I thought it wasn't his best game. I thought the attitude, you know, you could see there was... Arsenal clearly had an idea of, we'll slow the game down by going down. You know, there was a lot of... injury breaks and sort of, oh, you know, I'm injured, by Arsenal players who were able to continue taking a long time over goal kicks and set pieces and this type of stuff, which was kind of actually rather than achieving the desired effect of, like, everyone's losing interest in the game and losing focus and everything is becoming stagnant here and that's the way we want it because we're running down the clock. It actually was annoying the crowd and sort of hyping them up, I think, in a similar manner that happened at the Newcastle game there earlier this season, which Liverpool did manage to win late on. But there were some other games on, not least yesterday, where I wasn't watching it live. But I saw that Leeds were winning 1-0. I thought, well, it looks like Leeds are getting out of it. The next I saw, they were 5-1 down. And Roy Hodgson, I mean, this is looking like an absolute masterstroke. Just bringing Roy Hodgson in seems to be the best decision. Of all the teams that are changing managers, some of them haven't succeeded yet in appointing a new one. You know, Leicester, apparently, Jesse Marsh has decided... he's not going to join Leicester. They lost to Bournemouth and are really in big trouble now. But bringing Roy Hodgson into Palace just seems to have absolutely liberated this team. Suddenly they look as good as they kind of had threatened to be. And the player who just stood out in that game yesterday just gave an absolutely outstanding performance was Michael Olise. This was a seriously brilliant performance by him, just in a lot of different ways. The thing that sort of caught my eye first was just the quality of the ball for IU's headed goal, which made it 2-1 to Palace. It was absolutely brilliant. I mean, the whole thing was brilliant. You know, the ball is played to him on the right. It looks like maybe he's going to just knock it back to his teammate, but then he sees the teammate's under too much pressure here. I've got to kind of deal with this. Delays, then just takes a little sidestep, and from an almost standing position, put over a ball with so much pace that I'm not going to say he couldn't miss, but it put him in a position, even though he's quite far out, to put a really powerful header on the goal. I just thought it was a brilliant ball. And then he proceeds to set up the next two goals with great play. And I just thought, and also the thing that I liked about it, Owen, was if you noticed his part in the celebrations, I know that you commented before, Michael Olise is somewhat withdrawn reactions when he scored a goal, the brilliant free kick against Manchester United earlier this season.
Man United, yeah.
And then
there was also, do you remember, there was also the comment that he gave, the interview he gave about another goal he scored earlier this season.
Just talk us through it.
Through what, the goal? I think Wolf passed me the ball, shot, scored.
So yeah, he doesn't get too worked up about scoring goals.
No, but you should have seen him on how happy he was to assist these goals. He was, he had no problem celebrating. Maybe he just gets a bit uncomfortable when he's the center of attention. He's like, yeah, whatever. You know, do you thank the postman for delivering the mail? But
I didn't notice the assist celebrations. What was he was going wild, was he?
Well, not wild, but he was smiling.
than he does when he scores.
There was a smile on his face, which I thought, oh, you know, he does take some pleasure in his work when things go well. It's always nice to see. So I thought he was really good. Philip Billing was also really good for Bournemouth. It's kind of interesting to compare those two guys. If you could combine them into one player, he would be the best player in the league, because Billing scores like at a ridiculous rate for a central midfielder, but isn't that involved in the game. And Olise is just the opposite. He doesn't score anywhere near what you think he would score, given how good he is at various other elements of the game, but is involved in everything. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe someone can work on that, combining the two of them, although they both, I thought, are looking like really good. But, I mean, this is something which I guess will come into play a bit more in the summer. I mean, there's always some good players in teams that get relegated. Although at the moment, it looks as though both Crystal Palace and Bournemouth
won't be Palace.
Are probably
well,
going to be.
It is absolutely hilarious. Get rid of Hodgson. Bring in Vieira. It was going on for, it was a sense, let's just, you know, well, let's get rid of Hodgson. I mean, Hodgson retires, let's give him that. But I think there was a feeling within Crystal Palace that we're ready to move on from Roy Hodgson and move and let a younger, you know, more exciting manager get a hold of this incredible attacking talent that we have at our disposal and see what they can do with it. And now it's like, get rid of Vieira playing awful football. Bring back Roy Hodgson to hammer in the goals as he's done in the two games so far. Fair play to him.
Yeah, no, it's and it seems like it's already mission accomplished. I mean, it's not mathematically accomplished, but it is. I mean, come on, you know, it's looking pretty good. They maybe have to win one more game or two more games. Yeah.
There are a lot of really, really, really bad teams a long way behind them now.
Yes, yes. Now, what about the game you were covering on Saturday?
Oh yeah, that was action packed.
Well, this was crazy.
From the start. Did you see the Zerbi Stellini thing before the opening, before the first whistle, yeah?
Well, this is Zerbi. I mean, the man is just such a star. I mean, is this his third red card or only his second? I can't quite...
I believe second.
He'd already been sent off twice before, or this is the third sending off, or just the second sending off. But you could sort of see this sending off coming right from the start of the game, where he walked out onto the pitch and immediately became embroiled in a row with Christian Stellini. The genesis of which I did not understand until you were explaining something at halftime about how he'd called him an aggressive player.
Well, there was a pre-match press conference, right? So these guys, they played against each other in Serie B quite often. And they've also coached. I was looking for this at halftime. I did notice in the build-up, Stellini was asked about him, right? And he was asked, oh, will he be a coach of a top six club? You know, which was a hilarious question, because he, at the time of that question being asked, Deserby was a coach of a top six club.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we all know what top six means. And it Stellini means understood the question as well. Yeah, yeah.
Is he going to replace you as Tottenham manager?
Stellini says, yeah, yeah, you know, I hope so, but I don't know. And then he went on to basically give an appraisal of his managerial achievements and what he's done with Brighton. And it all seemed fairly polite and all that kind of stuff. He was asked about, it was mentioned that they had a playing rivalry. He said, yeah, he was very aggressive as a player. And of course, Brighton play aggressively both on and with and without the ball. You know, they play a very good game, blah, blah, blah. So maybe it was that word aggressive that
But aggressive is literally what everybody in the Premier League is demanding from their team. That's Roy Hodgson masterminded the 5-1 destruction of Leeds by saying the word aggression repeatedly to his players at half time. This is what he said. Jurgen Klopp has spent the last, I don't know how many weeks, begging for aggression from his team. Frank Lampard at Wolves, the reason why we lost, we lacked aggression. I mean, aggression is apparently the key to all football success. So being accused
also, I don't
of
think you're
aggression,
exactly disproving a point by being called, if you're pissed off about being called aggressive, I don't think the best way to disprove the point is to go up and jab your finger in the chest of the opposing manager just before the start of a game.
But all of this is obviously building the legend of De Zerbi, you know, the bad boy coach who just can't stop getting sent off. And also winning games, apart from at Spurs when they lost. And they lost because they got absolutely ridden by the referee. So the PGMOL has already apologized to Brighton for screwing them in this game. This is the third time they've apologized to Brighton in the last few weeks. The first was when Fabinho injured Evan Ferguson with that tackle from behind and the ref did nothing. The second was when, if you recall, they were playing Palace, scored a goal, and the VAR then disallowed it by drawing the offside line in the wrong place, right? Now, this is a sequence of mistakes. And then it leads up to this Tottenham game. Now, I should say Tottenham won, which at least spared us another round of this he hit me and it felt like a kiss stuff from the Spurs fan accounts reposting that Antonio Conte's "this is the story of Tottenham" speech, right? So at least we didn't have to do that again. But
yeah,
this the so many decisions in the game went against Brighton. Like, Roberto De Zerbi is a combustible character, right? I would love to hear what he... They should have been showing us live footage of De Zerbi, particularly for that penalty that wasn't given. So the incident that PG Mall have apologized for is the blatant penalty when Højbjerg stood on the foot of Mitoma and brought him down, which is it's so clear that it's just, how can you not give that? I mean, this is the problem with VAR. Once you've got VAR, there is no excuse for that. It's just like, okay, well, what are you going to do about it? The evidence was there, the evidence was ignored. What's going to happen now? Right? What has to happen now, in my view, is accountability. You know, I mean, the evidence is there, the evidence is ignored. So, what's going on? Now, Howard Webb, he's already got rid of one member of the staff this season, Lee Mason. Well, now it seems to me that there has to be further accountability. I mean, how can you get so many things wrong? And remember, there was a lot of things that happened in this game. So Brighton had two goals disallowed for handball. In both cases, you could have argued that goal should have stood. In one of the cases, the ball hits a player's possibly elbow, but from another angle, it looks like it maybe doesn't even touch his elbow. This is Welbeck's shot that deflected in off a teammate. Maybe it only hits his hip. The arm is down by his side. It's clearly unintentional, but I suppose they've disallowed that because, well, if it's a handball and it's the last touch on a goalbound shot, then technically we have to. So, okay, so that's their argument there. They could probably defend that one. The Mitoma one, there's a goal disallowed against Mitoma for offside. Now, here's another problem that they've created for themselves. Apparently, this shirt sleeve thing, you know, if it's the shirt sleeve, then it's not offside. Then it's not handball. And you can score with your shirt sleeve, which is why they'll draw the offside line from there. You know what I mean? Because that you can be, if you can score with that, then that's where the offside line starts. Right, it's the furthest forward part of your body that you can score with. So they'll do it there. The ball clearly hits him there on the shoulder. He controls it, scores, should be a goal. And they disallow it for some reason. Then they don't give this penalty. And then there's another penalty, which is a shirt pull, which is clearly a foul. You know, it's another one, and they don't give that. So that's a lot of decisions in the same direction with the outcome that Brighton, a team with realistic hopes.
Just on the disallowed goal, the Mitoma one where he handled the ball and where it exactly hit him and all that kind of stuff. It was given as, like, I think it was a debatable enough one because it was, firstly, the ref gave... It was disallowed on the field.
The assistant referee,
so VAR would have had to. Yeah, the assistant referee actually disallowed, which is amazing eyesight from there to know exactly where on the body it hit. But anyway, from that point on, I think you could argue that VAR it was hard. We watched a load of replays on TV, and it was hard to find any conclusively saying that it didn't happen. In fact, actually, the two pundits we had on, Stephen Kelly and Paul Robinson, both felt it was handball anyway. So, but that was a debatable one. The penalty you're talking about, the Højbjerg one, was absolutely like, but that's the one that's been apologised for. So that's been not sorted, but at least acknowledged. Yeah,
what are they going to do with all? What are Brighton going to do with all these apologies? You know.
Maybe do three apologies make 1 point in the league table? They should have that rule.
Send the apologies off to UEFA.
If PGMOL apologised to you three times in a season, it becomes an official point on the table.
Well, it's just totally ridiculous. And now, I suppose, you know, De Zerbi, I assume, will be punished for his stuff. I mean, they ended up getting sent off because De Zerbi was again at the centre of another big ruckus. And was he taunting Stellini after Brighton scored? you know, Stellini then was refusing to acknowledge him, but was sent off for failing to control his bench.
I think it was a bit harsh on Stellini from what I saw, unless something else went on that we didn't see.
Yeah.
I feel like he was doing it. But did you mention the Longley shirt pull? Did you mention that?
That was the second.
That should have been a penalty as well.
It should. I mean, if it's a shirt pull, it's a foul. I mean, it's a simple rule. But now, not in this case. No, not enough in it for me. So once again, Brighton at the sharp end of all those things. I don't know. I mean, what they can do. But I just wonder if accountability is once again going to be a feature of the response. I mean, it's all getting a little bit Squid Game over there at PGMOL, you know? You know, we're going to be just Aaron Webb sitting there at the end, you know? But this is what happens, you know, when VAR raises the stakes. You could previously have said, look, I didn't see it. It happened in a second. It was one of those things. Sometimes the referee misses things. Sometimes he sees things that aren't there. You end up with imperfect decisions. The thing is, you also end up with imperfect decisions with VAR. It's just that nobody can really explain them. So, you know, it's just
they always go against Brighton.
That's the other thing. Brighton do get screwed quite a lot. I mentioned Lampard. Obviously, his return didn't go as perhaps he might have envisaged. A great goal by Mateus Nunez. And then Chelsea couldn't score. I think they only had one shot on target in the end. He replaced the whole... the whole three-man front line was subbed off. He changed back to a back four, which I think is probably a good move for Chelsea. Although the question is whether, you know, Koulibaly is necessarily going to be that good in a four. But yeah, I mean, they're playing Real Madrid this week, so that's going to be big. Now, Real Madrid lost on the weekend. They lost 3-2 to Villarreal. Mm. I mean, is there a chance of this happening? Is there a chance? I mean, there's a chance. It's a football game. But I don't know. I kind of feel as though it's going to be... Is this just going to be what it's like for Lampard? You know, just sort of sitting there explaining why you've lost matches. I mean, what is it that's such a draw about this? I see that in El País Diego Torres reports, he's earning 5 million euros net for the 2 months. So maybe that's got something to do with it. But...
Yeah, I think that might have something to do with it. There's a certain prestige, particularly in Frank Lampard's world, to managing Chelsea. And, you know...
Well, in anyone's world. I mean, if you were appointed manager of Chelsea, I'd be pretty impressed, though. I would consider that.
No, that would, that would certainly raise the opinion of my peers of my football acumen, that's for sure. Or would it? I don't know. Todd Bowley, and being appointed by Todd Bowley at the moment maybe isn't a great barometer. But also, they can knock feckin' Real Madrid out of the Champions League, which would be hilarious if Frank Lampard does that.
I mean, it can... It could. I mean, I don't expect it to happen. I will set my stall out very clearly. I'm not expecting that. But as we know, sometimes I've expected things about Real Madrid matches in the Champions League which haven't turned out that way.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
People call them rats because a rat will do anything to survive. Isn't that right, Mr. Hill?
Objection.
I would not give Real Madrid a rat's chance against Chelsea.
Didn't give them a rat's chance.
If they get through against Chelsea, Owen, I do not give them a rat's chance.
Okay, there's rat's chance. Yeah. No rat's chance.
Camavinga searching for Benzema, who hooks it in, the goal and back. It's Rodrigo.
I just don't see it.
Still, come on.
I will not give Real Madrid a rat's
against
chance.
City.
Not a rat's chance. It's going to catch up with you eventually. Like, I don't believe in magic. I believe in reality. I believe in material reality.
Here comes Benzema. Side puts the ball in.
I don't know nothing about being a rat.
Mr. Hill, you know everything about being a rat.
I thought they would lose to PSG. They'd beat PSG. I thought they would lose to Chelsea. They'd beat Chelsea. I thought they would lose to Manchester City. And really, they should have lost to Manchester City.
And what about Liverpool then? Are you giving them a chance against Liverpool?
No.
All right, what a weekend that was. Richard Jolly was at Anfield and also Old Trafford for The Independent. Richard, how are you?
Good, thanks. You?
Well, I'm all right. I'm particularly interested to hear how Andrew Mangan, Arseblog's Andrew Mangan, is today, Andrew. I'd imagine just working through your emotions 24 hours on?
A little bit, yeah. It was pretty intense. A fairly extraordinary game, I think. One that Arsenal probably should have won, but when you come down to it right at the end, could easily have lost. So to come away with a point is probably all right in the grand scheme of things.
Okay, because I did want to ask you, Jeff Shreve seemed very intent on getting a definitive answer to the question of whether this was 2 points dropped or a point gained. It sounds like you're just about in the 1 point gained camp there.
Yeah, I think you have to acknowledge that when your goalkeeper makes 3 world-class saves in the last 5 minutes, and Liverpool miss a penalty during the second half, a point away at Anfield, a ground that Arsenal haven't really got a great track record at, you know, you have to take that. Even though the fact that we were 2-0 up doing really well, it's the sort of position where you would like to go on and win the game. And even the lateness of the equalizer is like a punch in the stomach as well. So it's trying to find the balance between all of those things. In the end, I think if you'd said to people at the start of this season, Arsenal will take 4 points off Liverpool home and away, they would have taken that, you know, no questions asked. That's what we've done. You know, it could have been better, but it easily could have been worse. So it's mixed emotions, as Ramsdale said on
Sky.
You
said a word there in your answer, Andrew, which I sense is being used a lot by Arsenal people as kind of a magical incantation that sort of negates the mistakes that they made. And the word was Anfield. Do you think that Arsenal, and particularly their manager, kind of fetishize Anfield a little bit, that too much is made of the power of this mighty stadium?
I don't know if it's just Arsenal. I think that came across yesterday in the Sky coverage, you know, the Anfield crowd, you don't want to wake them up, all that kind of stuff. I mean, I think that just plays out in the media in general. You look at the way that Arteta tried to prepare the team last season going to Anfield in the All or Nothing documentary.
It's the best advertising for Anfield that there's ever been. I've never seen such respect.
Yeah, he took out the speakers and plays You'll Never Walk Alone and all that kind of stuff. I think it's more about the record that Arsenal have there than the stadium itself. I think it becomes a bit of a psychological obstacle.
Arsenal have one of the greatest moments in their history at that stadium.
Well, that's it. And maybe we're paying the price for it ever since. I don't know. But, you know, it's 2012 since we won there. And, you know, that was a team where Lukas Podolski and Santi Cazorla scored their first ever Arsenal goals, and that will tell you just how long ago it is.
It was my wedding day, Andrew. I remember it well.
Well, there you go.
How long ago it was.
What a wonderful day for both of us that was, Ken. But yeah, I mean, that does tell you how long ago it was, and I think that's maybe the key factor rather than the crowd, because you get passionate crowds everywhere. The first day of the season, Arsenal went to Crystal Palace, and everyone talked about, you know, Friday night, Crystal Palace away from home, how vociferous and boisterous that crowd is, and Arsenal dealt with it pretty well. So I do think it's more about what we have done and haven't done at Anfield rather than Anfield itself.
Rich, you were there in the belly of the beast. The thing that surprises me is that this is a very strange beast where you can run around in its belly, hockeying the home team 2-0, completely outclassing them. But one off-the-ball barge, and all bets are off. I mean, how do you explain that? Why are two goals apparently not enough to wake up Anfield, but just one slightly disrespectful action from Granit Xhaka changes the whole story? What did it feel like? What did the energy feel like to you sitting there?
Well, such is the mysterious power of Granit Xhaka, because things do happen to Granit Xhaka much as Granit Xhaka makes things happen. And you do wonder if, had that incident with Trent Alexander-Arnold been any other player, whether it would have actually sparked a Liverpool comeback, or whether Xhaka's just really unlucky in that respect. Because certainly Mikel Arteta was keen to point out that Arsenal could have made it 3-0 a couple of minutes later. Equally, it did rouse the crowd. It did get them going. And sometimes it does just need something like that. And when you kind of watch it back, you suspect that maybe Alexander-Arnold was quite keen for that to happen, to get everyone on their feet and roused and angry with Arsenal. But Arsenal for that first half hour were absolutely brilliant. Saka and Martinelli were the two best players on the pitch. Martinelli's biggest fan for several years has been Jurgen Klopp, but that doesn't mean he knows how to stop him. But then Liverpool are in this strange state now where you look at the league table and they're kind of surrounded by Brighton and Brentford, and they've got as many points away from home as Southampton. But every now and again, they can trigger that memory of how they were a great team, and then they can become a great team, or at the least a very good team, for passages of games, sometimes even an entire game. And it's often the sort of challenge to rouse them. And it's kind of no coincidence that they've got this outstanding home record against the top teams, you know, including, of course, the 7-0 against Manchester United. But the 1-0 over Manchester City was a fantastic atmosphere and a fantastic performance. And for an hour yesterday, they, out of nothing, really, they did batter Arsenal, which made it all the odder that they keep losing to relegation-threatened teams.
Andrew, are you pinning it on Granit Xhaka?
I really think that's overplayed, to be honest. I think Arsenal didn't defend that passage of play well enough. It's, you know, maybe not ideal, but it's the sort of thing that happens in football all the time. Two players come together. I don't think two yellow cards woke Anfield up. I think it was the goal, the ball hitting the back of the net, that woke Anfield up.
Well, they were roaring their head off as soon as it happened, especially when he turned back after the initial altercation. Yeah. Trent doesn't go back at him, then Xhaka turns around. That really, the crowd did lift in that moment.
Maybe so. You know, I think it's just overblown, really. If Arsenal defend the way they should have defended in the build-up to Salah's goal, then it goes, you know, it's 2-0 at halftime and nobody's talking about Granit Xhaka today. And I don't think what Xhaka did had any real bearing on the goal itself. So, look, we know he's got some history. He's got a bit of a track record of stuff like this. But, you know, I think that
he's
part of it is...
He's got a track record this season of being very good. To be
well,
fair.
That's it.
But when you talk about the defending that in the build-up to that goal, I mean, where would you be, you know, what do you think needed to be done better?
Well, I think Ben White got pulled out of position, so they had space to drive into down Liverpool's left, our right-hand side. Maybe the communication between Martin Odegaard and Thomas Partey wasn't quite what it should have been. I think Odegaard was tracking Jota who overlapped and Partey wasn't quick enough to react. And then I also think there's just a bit of good fortune to that goal as well, because I think Henderson's trying a shot, he miscues, and it just falls perfectly for Salah, and it deflected in off Gabriel. So there is an element of good fortune to that. But I think Arsenal will look at that goal and think they could have dealt with that passage of play.
Rich, I have to say, all of the Anfield talk, I felt deflected away from maybe something more relevant, which I thought Mikel Arteta in this game went negative too early. Being 2-0 up with an hour to play, naturally you're going to think, oh, you know, it'd be nice if this game could finish 2-0. But I felt sometimes Arsenal, you know, even before the substitution that he made, which maybe we can also talk about, but I felt that Arsenal's attitude from the point they went 2-0 up was kind of like, yeah, you know, let's blow this one up. There was a lot of going down, feigning injury. There was a lot of time wasting, which is something Arsenal themselves have obviously complained about. I mean, the Saka booking was hilarious. I mean, the way that he was walking over to take that corner, although that was pretty late in the game. Did Mikel Arteta, did his belief in the victory falter here?
Possibly, and that could come into the whole Anfield thing that seems to affect Arsenal. I mean, certainly when we were watching the game then in the second half, we did note at the time that it was, I think, 45, 46 minutes between Alisson having anything to do from picking the ball out the back of his net for the second goal until Arsenal next had any kind of attempt.
Because it looked at the second goal, so this could be a 4-0 here. You know, this could be a real humbling for Liverpool here, the way this game is going. And that's, you know, it just, Arsenal didn't follow up.
Yeah, and the start Arsenal made reminded me of the way that Klopp's Liverpool used to start games when they were in their 100-mile-an-hour phase. And sometimes then they would go 2-0 up and end up desperately trying to hang on. But sometimes then they go 2-0 up and try and make it 3-0 and 4-0. And Arsenal, when you looked at how dominant Martinelli was and how well they were playing, they might reflect on that as a missed opportunity. But certainly to come back to the substitution that you mentioned earlier, I can understand Arteta's thinking to some extent, and Andrew will probably have more information on this than me, but I think earlier on in the season, Rob Holding made quite a lot of appearances as a very late substitute as a third centre-back. This time, obviously, he was starting. This time he brought Kiwior on as the third substitute, and he probably did it a bit earlier. But it just completely backfired, because you look at the number of chances that Liverpool had when Arsenal were playing five at the back. And even though Liverpool have been putting pressure on for the second half, when Arsenal had an extra defender and one fewer player in the midfield, it was even more chances. It was just non-stop. And maybe the substitution was a reaction to seeing Klopp flood the game with forwards as people like Darwin Nunez and Roberto Firmino came on. But again, it does speak to a negativity rather than a confidence in his initial game plan and his initial system.
Is this a habit of Mikel Arteta's that you've noticed? I mean, the results this season have almost uniformly been good for Arsenal. But I must say, when I saw Kiwior, you know, coming on for Odegaard, I thought, well, my first thought was literally, who? Like, what is happening here? And then it was like, right, okay, they're obviously sort of going five at the back, and, you know, they're going to try and cling on here. I mean, what were your thoughts at the time, and how do you think the decision looks in hindsight?
Mikel Arteta hasn't made too many mistakes this season, but I think he will look at that one and think he probably got it wrong. If he could do it again, I don't think he'd do exactly that, because if you look at the way the second half went, between the 57th and 81st minute, Liverpool did not have a single attempt on goal. They were dominant, I think, but they did not have an attempt on goal. He took Odegaard off, put Kiwior on. Kiwior's first action was to come out of his zone, completely miss the ball, and Darwin Nunez had a great chance, which Aaron Ramsdale made a brilliant save from. And after that, you know, all the momentum was with Liverpool. I think in general this season, Arteta's substitutions have been much more positive. This one, you know, I think if William Saliba and Gabriel had started the game, and you bring on a player with the experience of Rob Holding, you could understand it a little bit more. Kiwior, this was only his second appearance, and I'm not sure that Anfield turned up to 11 is the right game to give him more Premier League minutes in the context. I can kind of understand what Arteta was trying to do, but it really didn't work. Maybe, you know, Odegaard wasn't having his best game, but I think just trying to have players on the pitch who could, you know, calm things down, put their foot in the ball, slow it down a little bit would have been a little bit better. He took a gamble, went to defend the lead, and ultimately it didn't pay off. And, you know, this is where I think this is more of a turning point in the game than the Granit Xhaka thing, for example.
Rich, I know that you were actually there, so you wouldn't have had the pleasure of listening to the Sky broadcast.
Oh no, I watched the analysis back at the end when I got home when I was writing something. So I did see Roy Keane on Andy Robertson.
Oh yeah, we'll get to that. that we've got a little section for that part, but I was struck by the analysis of Trent Alexander-Arnold. I mean, did you at the game, you know, in real time, realize that he was the real villain of the game, that everything that happened to in the game was kind of his fault? You know, everything bad that happened to his team was his fault. Were you sitting there thinking, this guy is a cod, he's got to go?
No, I mean, I think much as he's in this position now where he appears this incredibly emblematic figure, and he was in yesterday's game in that Martinelli, who is sort of his direct opponent, scores one goal and makes one goal, and yet the game ends with Alexander-Arnold crossing for Roberto Firmino to head in, and that's very much the two sides of Trent, you know, the defensive problems and the attacking brilliance. I think it's certainly interesting the way that Klopp always seems to send him out again in these games against people he's had problems with in the past. And whenever they play Real Madrid, Trent against Vinicius Jr. is one that can become a bit one-sided and not...
Well, Trent arguably resuscitated Vinicius Jr.'s career at Real Madrid. You know, I mean, literally, you know, his... was it 3-1 the Real Madrid?
The lockdown, you know, game a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and that sparked Vinicius at Madrid. People were thinking, we should get rid of this guy. He hasn't done anything. Then he destroyed Liverpool and Trent in that game, and has thrived against them ever since. They've been it's like Dr. Liverpool for him. I mean, obviously he's gone from strength to strength since then. But yeah, I mean, that certainly was the first massive crisis that I can remember since Trent Alexander-Arnold became a really a big player. That was the moment when everyone said, hang on, this guy.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that was interesting yesterday was that Klopp seemed to be suddenly trying to copy Guardiola's tactic with John Stones and Rico Lewis of moving them into the midfield, which Trent was sometimes playing in that kind of deeper role, which may have been an attempt to partly to use his playmaking gifts in the centre of the pitch, but partly also to ensure that Ibrahima Konate was dealing with Martinelli at times. But even then, I don't think that works, because if you look at the second goal, what it means is that Konate, a sort of 6'4" centre back, has come across to the right wing to close down Martinelli. And so that when the cross comes into the box, yes, maybe Virgil van Dijk's moved across a bit too far, but then Gabriel Jesus's header is against Andy Robertson, a kind of 5'8" left back. But Liverpool and Alexander-Arnold at the moment, they appear to be in this position where they can't live with each other and can't live without each other. And you sometimes see some of the arguments of, well, move him into midfield, and you think, well, that takes away someone who has been one of the best right-backs in the world in the last few years, and with no guarantee he'll be any better there, and creating a situation where they have to sign a high-class right-back. And yet it does feel too often this season that, A, his defending hasn't improved, and, B, he's not really getting the protection he ought to. And it's just a series of ordeals for him at the moment. I mean, the Manchester City game, when Jack Grealish had perhaps his best game for City, but it was up against
Trent. Best game so far.
Well, yes, but it was against Trent. And so you say, has Vinicius' best game for Real Madrid come against Trent? Has Martinelli's best game for Arsenal come against Trent?
Well, what about that incident Richard, that you alluded to there between Andy Robertson and the assistant referee, Konstantin Hatzidakis. We know what Roy Keane thinks of it, thinks Robertson's being a big baby, but rather an unusual sight to see a player apparently elbowed by a match official.
Yeah, I mean, I think we do have to watch out for a new era of vigilante assistant referees, you know, just have to be careful in case Darren Cann suddenly starts gunning everyone down. I thought it was utterly bizarre when I first heard about it, and it does feel as though it's the week where football got even less credible than usual, with sort of Frank Lampard's comeback at Chelsea and Leicester trying to hire Jesse Marsh and assistant referees attacking Andy Robertson. It wasn't the most brutal assault of all time.
Neither was Mitrovic. neither was Mitrovic's assault, which he's been banned for 8 games. You know, I've seen more fearsome assaults than that. No?
Well, yes. I mean, you would have to assume, though, given that violent conduct does include lots of things that aren't hugely violent, and Everton fans might think of Abdoulaye Doucouré and Harry Kane at this point, that it did look a 3-match ban in the modern game, certainly.
What do you make of it, Andrew? I mean, you know, the Arsenal, is it fair to say, got Lee Mason sacked earlier this season?
No, I don't think that's fair at all.
You don't think that's fair?
No, I think Lee Mason made a terrible mistake, which, you know, cost Arsenal 2 points, which potentially could be the difference between the title and not the title. Arsenal didn't make that decision for anybody. I suppose the thing you would say is, since Howard Webb has come back in, it appears to have got worse. The incidents with referees and VAR, they just appear to be getting worse and worse every week. I think Robertson was, you know, that linesman is fairly well built.
I know. Yeah. I thought the same thing. It's like, this guy definitely lifts. Look at him.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, I don't think Robertson was expecting it, but I think he sort of surprised him, didn't he, with came from behind and maybe just startled him. So
the eyes a bit jumpy.
Yeah, exactly. I'm very, you know, very jumpy person. If you come at me from behind, reflexes will kick in.
It's a nightmare in a crowded bar.
This is it, Ken.
Well, the question is also whether or not Robertson should have been putting his hand on him in the first place.
Putting his hand. So Robertson put his hand. Did Robertson even do that? I mean, surely
it looks like it. I've watched the video back. It looks as though he puts his right hand on his right arm. Like, you know, he's saying, "Oh, yeah, come here, ref or assistant referee." And he's, I'm not, again, I'm gently enough, but there is a question that maybe, no matter how tactile you might be or how tempting it might be just to get an official's attention by physically touching them, maybe they should just be a touch-free zone at this point.
Well, I mean, maybe, but I'm not sure I really see any evidence that Robertson touched him at all. Did he not just sort of turn back towards him and the guy, I mean, I thought it was crazy. I mean, it just seems to me, in the context of what happened recently with Mitrovic, and, you know, this guy being absolutely hammered for this angry outburst that he had, okay, which, I mean, I remember being soft on him at the time and being a bit surprised by the punishment. Then the FA saying, well, he should be punished more. This is a disgrace. To have,
but Ken, there's an obvious difference there. Referees around England and Ireland are getting abused routinely by players, in some cases getting physically assaulted, in a lot of cases getting verbally abused. There's a problem there with attitudes to referees. And when someone like Mitrovic does what he does, there has to be a serious deterrent to that, because if that's allowed or in any way condoned in professional football, there is a knock-on effect, I think, elsewhere. I don't think there is a plague of, as far as I know, I could be corrected, of assistant referees going around leaving the elbow in on players that needs to be stamped out. Referees are the ones generally in these situations who are having a real tough time of it at the moment. So I think that's an obvious difference between the two cases here. No?
Well, we've started arguing amongst ourselves here, and Rich and Andrew are simply sitting there patiently listening to us. But I have to say, I mean, the obvious reason why there isn't a plague of referees going around intimidating players is that they're vastly outnumbered in every game. It would be a losing policy. I mean, it has to be a non-violence policy in order for this game to be feasible at all, which is one reason why I think violence from the refereeing side, and we use the word violence in its loosest possible sense here, but also needs to be clamped down on just as much as from the player's side. And I wonder what each of you, Rich and Andrew, think about that.
Well, I mean, I do think it's just a complete one-off, and that's I mean, as Owen said, referees are facing all sorts of attacks, often verbal, sometimes physical. I think one of the reasons why that incident yesterday was so bizarre was that most of us can't recall anything remotely similar from all of the thousands of games that that we've watched. I mean, maybe such thing will crop up from a South American game on YouTube sooner or later, but we're not used to seeing it. So in that respect, I don't think it's going to be the start of an epidemic like that. Equally, you do think there kind of has to be some sort of sanction, and it does raise a question as to what happens in a game after that. I mean, I'm not aware of that official having any particularly contentious decisions in the second half, but it does seem to open a can of worms if the penalty decision, for instance, after that is given by the linesman who was already elbowed Andy Robertson.
Andrew, any further thoughts on that?
I just thought it was kind of funny that Robertson got booked for getting, hit by the assistant. I mean, I think if you look at it again, he does sort of put his hand on him. The referee sort of does that to shrug him off. Like Rich said, I don't think we'll see anything like this again. It will be very interesting to see what kind of sanction this guy faces. A couple of weeks off to work on his guns in the gym, I guess. But I don't know, just part of the sort of entertainment value of yesterday, which I think was pretty high all the way through.
Andrew, Richard, cracking stuff. Thanks a million.
It's very difficult to see Arsenal play one day without Arsenal on the bench.
He's going to ruin the club, fam. He's going to ruin the club, lad. I'm telling you, fam.
But up and down the land, you do sense a genuine appreciation for the way this Arsenal team play. They were perfect.
It's turning. It's turning, blood. Did you hear the booze at full time? Seriously, shut the fuck up tonight. I'm not in no mood for no little dickheads chatting shit.
We love to have him there all the time, but we all know that's not going to happen. One day he's going to have to go.
Spineless, where were they in the second half? Spineless, no fucking character, no fucking leadership. Where does that boil down to? It boils down to the fucking manager. It's finished.
It will be hard. He's not thinking of leaving one day.
He was a great manager. He's gone. He's gone.
It will happen eventually. We all know it. But I don't see it.
Arsenal Football Club, lad.
For me, the day I will see Arsenal play without Arsenal on the bench, it's going to be weird.
Don't try to question my fan base, okay? I can't get angry like I am before, because it's just...
Arsene Wenger's team, every bit as good as the manager's words. He had no doubts. They are the champions. They have taken the title away from Manchester United, and they have done it here at Old Trafford. It does not get more conclusive than that.
All right, Champions League during the week. You have mentioned Real Madrid against Chelsea, Ken. That one's on Wednesday night, along with AC Milan, Napoli, Tuesday, Benfica against Inter Milan, and Man City against Bayern.
Yeah.
It's a decent week.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. I mean, that's City, Bayern. I mean, City, have we mentioned City? My God.
Well, just the Kyle Walker bit at the start.
Well, yeah, but I mean, but like the way that City are going at the moment is they've really got rolling. You know, Grealish is absolutely rolling now, playing brilliantly, looks so confident, has figured out how to be relevant in the team. It's 8 wins in a row, 4-1, 4-1, 6-0, 7-0. These are the results that they're getting in the last few games. And they seem to have found this gear that they hadn't been able to kind of slip into in the entire rest of the season. I mean, this is their longest winning streak by 2 matches, and it obviously has come more or less coincided with Guardiola's adoption of this new system. And I have to say that Guardiola has done a really good job here of managing this situation. I mean, you know, we were talking a couple of months ago about whether City were going to have some of the same issues that you've seen at Liverpool in terms of exhaustion. I mean, they're the only other team really that's played as many games and has kind of been through as many you know, demanding situations over the last few seasons, and a lot of it with some of the same players. Whether they were going to experience this sort of collapse that we've seen with Liverpool, but no, what Guardiola has managed to do is kind of provoke the team. I mean, maybe that's part of the stuff that he's saying about Walker. I mean, he knows that's insulting. You know, he knows that that's,
yeah, oh, absolutely,
that's tough.
Yeah.
But you know, it's like, okay, Cole, well, show me why you should be in the team. I mean, he's already bombed out Cancelo, who, by the way, it doesn't seem as though things are going all that well for him at Bayern since that has happened. But he's got rid of Cancelo, who, you know, was thought to be one of the main players in the team. He's changed the shape of the team. Now, it's one thing, like, so for instance, there's a big difference from Jurgen Klopp, who seldom does this. You know, he tends to pick the same sort of 4-3-3. And Guardiola, the team always has the same ethos. Like, they're always kind of playing the same kind of football, but he is prepared to change the shape quite a lot radically and use players in unfamiliar sorts of positions. And he keeps getting it right. You know, I mean, it's so easy to try something.
I mean, he did also ship off Zinchenko and Jesus to their title rivals Arsenal. So
yeah, I don't think that was his best. That was his best decision either. Although it's, you know, his alternative maybe was to sort of keep them on the squad against their will. I mean, he did hand Arsenal a couple of extremely useful players there. That is true, but I suppose maybe that's just his way of making it interesting. Because if he hadn't done that, I mean, City would almost have won the league already, and it would be, well, lads, I guess we're going to have to try and win the Champions League. Now, of course, the test for Guardiola has always been, you know, these sort of clever plans, the type of which have worked really well over the last few weeks in the Premier League, especially, have often come unstuck in the Champions League. And this is why this has been his one significant failing as a coach. It's like, well, you haven't managed to win the Champions League. It's one thing for a club with the sort of huge financial power of City to win a league title, you know, over 38 matches where like the power eventually tells. It's another thing in games where a team that doesn't have as much money can have a good night against you and knock you out. You know what I mean? And this has been why the Premier League has been more difficult. But at the moment, you look at the management. I mean, he's been there for so long. Things really could be going stale. I mean, you hear a lot, you know, from inside City that, oh, the players, some of the players who left, like Sterling, for instance, were kind of like, there's only a certain amount of Pep Guardiola that anyone can really take in one's life, you know, before it starts to really grind your gears. And I think there's always going to be an element of that with Pep because he's so demanding and occasionally not very tactful, like often not very tactful, but he has managed to come up with ways to kind of keep the players stimulated, maybe sometimes provoking them, but also systems in the game that are working, that are winning matches slightly differently from what they've been done before. And you have to at some point say this guy is really operating at the you know, he's regarded as the best manager in the world for a reason.
Thanks, Ken.
Thanks, Owen.
Thanks for listening. Sign up now for all the Champions League coverage, Irish women's team against USA, our Masters chat tomorrow, GA Championship. You'll also hear every episode ad-free if you become a member of the World Service. The Second Gabbins podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Which one is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's
World Service.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news.
Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.